Monday, January 21st, 2013, was a high holy day in our nation's civil religion. The second inauguration of our country's first black president was itself highly symbolic. But that day in January had the additional symbolism of being both Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and if you'll remember, also the anniversary month of Lincoln signing the Emancipation Proclamation. What a stunning three-step sweep of history. From President Lincoln's 1863 executive order freeing all slaves, 100 years later, to Dr. King's 1963 dream that, quote, one day this nation will rise up and live up to its creed that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And 50 years later, again to 2013, and our nation's first black president once again taking the oath of office as president of the United States. 1863 to 1963 to 2013. But despite this historic trajectory of real progress, books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in an Age of Colorblindness, which this congregation has studied fairly closely, remind us of how far we have to go to achieve more fully the freedom and equality promised by America's founding ideals. And also, despite the knowledge 4 years later that President Obama was in the end only human, like the rest of us, with limitations and imperfections, still on that day in January, only 1 year ago, the sense of historical connection was palpable. The movement from the end of the Civil War to the victories for civil rights to the pomp and circumstance of civil religion, re-inaugurating our nation's first black president. And in President Obama's second inaugural address, one of the most memorable passages was the following words, which echo both Jefferson and King. Quote, "We, the people, declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall. Just as it guided all those men and women, sung and unsung, who left footprints on this great mall to hear a preacher say that we cannot walk alone, to hear a king proclaim that our individual freedom is inextricably bound to the freedom of every soul on earth." And within that memorable passage, the part that most strongly resonated with me and many others was our nation's first black president inscribing into the annals of American history the formulation Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall. It would have been enough to rest on the inherent rich symbolism of that historic day. It would have been enough for President Obama to rest on the historical sweep from Jefferson to Lincoln to King to himself. It would have been enough to celebrate the re-election to the highest office in our land of an African American named Barack Hussein Obama. That would have been enough. But President Obama's alliterative allusion to Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall pointed beyond the significance embodied in his own person to the larger sweep of social justice movements in our country of which he is a part. Dr. Melissa Harris Perry, an African-American political scientist, pundit, and Unitarian Universalist, I'll add, described the importance this way. When the president name-checked the watershed moments of women's rights, civil rights, and LGBT equality movements, he offered a powerful moment of official recognition. A powerful moment of official recognition. Seneca Falls, as you may know, is a city in New York that was the site of an important women's rights convention in 1848. Selma is a city in Alabama that was the beginning point of three attempted protest marches in 1965 for African American voting rights, in which the nonviolent marchers were met with violent, brutal, and bloody opposition. And Stonewall is a Greenwich Village bar in New York City where in 1969, members of the LGBT community rose up against the injustice of weekly raids by police and launched what is widely considered to be the start of the modern fight for LGBT rights in the U.S. Again, in President Obama's words, "We the people declare today that the most evident of truths, that all of us are created equal, is the star that guides us still, just as it guided our forebears through Seneca Falls, through Selma, through Stonewall." As you've heard me say before, the stories that we choose to tell really matter. And seeing that story, that interconnected story of the struggle for human rights that spans from Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall, learning to see that story as our story, as a quintessential American story, fulfilling the Jeffersonian promise laid out in the Declaration of Independence, that's a powerful and a vital story for us to claim and to learn to tell boldly. That social justice story helps shape us, our society, and the society that we hope to create for future generations. For too long, a different story has been told in our country. As Melissa Harris-Perry also notes, Ralph Ellison described the recognition issue for Black Americans as being a, quote, invisible man. For women, Betty Friedan lamented it as, quote, the problem that has no name. LGBT Americans have long identified it as the closet. In each case, the challenge is the same, a lack of fair and accurate recognition. The official denials and delays that have long beset social justice movements make it all the more significant when official recognition comes, as in President Obama's highlighting of Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, as connected both to one another and to the ideals of liberty and equality that America at its best represents. And I intentionally scheduled this sermon at the beginning of that two-month period that spans February to March of Black History Month into Women's History Month. And there's a growing movement to name October as LGBT History Month. And as important as these interim steps are of having focal months for aspects of multiculturalism, the end goal is to fully integrate into our story of ourselves as a nation that Black history, of course, is American history. Women's history is American history. Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender history is American history. The hope is that the day will soon come when the stories of marginalized groups will be so woven into how we tell our story that there will be a greater sense of one pluralistic, multicultural tapestry of American history. E pluribus unum. Out of many, one. But we're not there yet. And for now, I suspect that many Americans don't know the history of Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall. If you didn't know the origins of one or more of these places, I don't blame you. I blame your history teachers. I blame the ones who wrote the curriculum, really. And I invite you to respond not with shame at not knowing that history that you have not yet learned, but in gratitude for the inaugural address from the highest office in the land that invites us to learn to better tell the robust, interconnected struggle for social justice in our land. As Dr. King challenged us to remember in his wonderful, if you haven't read it recently, go back and read it, Letter from a Birmingham Jail, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." Our seventh UU principle calls this the interdependent web of all existence. From a related angle, our first UU principle reminds us that every person, no matter what, no matter what, has inherent worth and dignity. And for those of you who watched President Obama's State of the Union address this past week, did you notice that line that sounded a lot like our UU first principle? He said, quote, "We believe in the inherent dignity and equality of every human being, regardless of race or religion or creed or sexual orientation. We believe in the inherent dignity and equality." Some of you will know that President Obama went to UU Sunday School in Hawaii. The point is that knowing, claiming, and asserting each person's inherent worth and dignity was at the heart of Seneca Falls, of Selma and Stonewall. It's what fueled women, African Americans, and LGBT folk, and so many other marginalized groups across history to rise up and to persevere against deadly, powerful opposition. They knew deep within that they were right, and that their inherent worth and dignity was being unjustly denied, and that the system supporting that injustice, that part was wrong. And I invite you to hold in your heart all those who continue to struggle for social justice, for the recognition of every person's inherent worth and dignity. And I likewise invite you to more fully experience right now the truth of your inherent worth and dignity. As the choir sings these words, how could anyone ever tell you you were anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you you were anything less than whole? How could anyone fail to notice that your loving is a miracle? How deeply you're connected to my soul. In the first part of this morning's sermon, I spoke about the significance of our first black president, pointing beyond the importance of his own symbolic achievements to the larger sweep of social justice movements that were catalyzed at Seneca Falls and Selma and Stonewall. And in this second section, I'd like to reflect briefly on some of the ways that those social justice movements for women's rights, for African American civil rights, for LGBT equality have interwoven and inspired one another. Consider Frederick Douglass, an African-American born into slavery in the early 19th century, who escaped and became a leader in the abolitionist struggle. He was known for his skills at public speaking, even though he had been born into slavery. His eloquence and his erudition were an embodied refutation of racial inferiority myths. And it would have been enough if Douglass had employed his considerable gifts solely to secure greater racial equality. But Douglass looked beyond his own self-interest to work for the freedom of all people. To name one of many examples, Frederick Douglass was one of 31 men who attended that early women's rights convocation at Seneca Falls. And he was the only man invited to speak. Later, near the end of his life, he said, quote, "When I ran away from slavery, that was for myself. When I advocated emancipation, that was for my people. But when I stood up for the rights of women, self was out of the question, and I found nobility in that act." Douglass's witness reminds us that when we advocate for the inherent worth and dignity of every person, that's one of the most profound ways of experiencing and claiming that inherent worth and dignity for yourself, realizing that it applies to you as well. Jumping ahead a century to 1970, Huey Newton, the radical African-American co-founder of the Black Panthers, said, quote, "When we have revolutionary conferences, rallies, and demonstrations, there should be full participation of the gay liberation movement and the women's liberation movement." As one self-proclaimed queer historian puts it, there's a clear resonance between gay is good and black is beautiful. Both were rhetorical flourishes used in speeches to succinctly encapsulate the shift in consciousness that their respective social justice movements were seeking. Or to name a related link between the feminist and LGBT rights struggles, the popularity of the birth control pill in the 1960s unintentionally but happily made the separation between sex and reproduction socially acceptable in a way that helped set the groundwork for public consciousness raising for LGBT rights, which were catalyzed in 69 at the Stonewall Inn riots. As I've said before, the stories that we choose to tell matter. And I hope it's clear by now that my motivation this morning in taking the time to unpack President Obama's line about Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall is that it's vitally important for us to learn to better tell our history in a way that highlights social justice movements and how they work together in coalitions to inspire one another, and how those different movements intentionally or unintentionally laid the groundwork for future social justice. The stories we choose to tell matter, and the story of Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall is not the story, no surprise probably, that of U.S. history that I learned to tell growing up in South Carolina. It's not the one I learned in my childhood church, but it's the one that I want our hypothetical children that my wife and I talk about sometime. It's the one that I want those children and your children learn growing up in this congregation. It's a story that I learned to tell more robustly when a friend urged me to read Howard Zinn's The People's History of the United States, which tells America's story from the point of view and in the words of America's women, factory workers, African Americans, Native Americans, the working poor, and immigrant laborers. If you haven't read that, I encourage you to do so. And in almost every case, from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall and beyond, each of these marginalized groups was galvanized as its members came to more fully know, claim, and assert the inherent worth and dignity of every person. What could claim to be more American than the words of our Unitarian forebear, Thomas Jefferson, in our fledgling nation's Declaration of Independence from the British monarchy? What could be more American than that? That we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, we the people. And what could be more American than individuals likewise rising up against any tyranny that denies that promise and that declaration, that denies any individual's inherent worth and dignity? Too often, liberals have ceded the ground of patriotism. Even if we rightly look beyond historically contingent borders of nation states to a larger common humanity and to a goal of world community, we do a deep disservice if we neglect how deeply the whole American experiment is grounded in liberal enlightenment values, of how deeply the American story at its best is precisely the story of freedom, of liberty, of equality. It's a story waiting to be reclaimed and proclaimed. As Dr. King said on behalf of the civil rights movement in the wake of Rosa Parks' arrest and in the midst of the Montgomery bus boycott, if we are wrong, the Supreme Court of this nation is wrong. If we are wrong, the Constitution of the United States is wrong. If we are wrong, God Almighty is wrong. And if we are wrong, justice is a lie. King concluded, right here in Montgomery, when the history books are written in the future, somebody will have to say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity into our civilization. King's words apply equally to so many other movements who have injected meaning and dignity into our civilization and helped others claim their inherent worth. I don't want to unduly bring us down, but in our exploration of Seneca Falls, Selma, and Stonewall, I would be remiss if I failed to name a few of the times that the civil rights movement was sexist, when the women's rights movement was heterosexist, etc. At that same meeting in which Dr. King spoke those resounding prophetic words in the wake of Rosa Parks' arrest, in the righteous goal of sustaining and encouraging the Montgomery bus boycott, a number of other African American men spoke with Dr. King, and Rosa Parks was recognized, but she was not invited to speak. As one biographer noted, it was a male-dominated movement. Related to the sexist exclusion of women from the civil rights movement's leadership, one historian notes that in the decade before Stonewall, Bayard Rustin, someone who deserves and will eventually receive from me a sermon of his own, Bayard Rustin, a longtime advisor and mentor in nonviolence thinking to Martin Luther King Jr., he was a gay black man responsible for several major successes of the civil rights movement. Rustin was deeply involved in the Montgomery bus boycott and then became the chief organizer of the March on Washington, for which he was featured on the cover of Life in September 1963. But at the same time that MLK was saying to white moderates about why we can't wait for racial equality, King was telling Rustin that gay rights had to wait for racial equality. Ironically, at the same time, Paul Murray, the first African-American female Episcopal priest and a closeted lesbian at the time, chastised Rustin and others for their exclusion of black women from the March on Washington's speaker list. To give just three more brief examples, Margaret Sanger, who was highly influential in forging a national movement for birth control and family planning, held racist, eugenicist views about non-white people. Founder of the National Organization for Women, Betty Friedan's, her anti-lesbian sentiments were so present in now that a group of lesbians formed the Lavender Menace. And finally, the way the story of the Stonewall riots have often been told in public has covered up the fact that transgender folk played a major role in leading the Stonewall riots. It's what's sometimes called cis-washing the Stonewall riots. You may know that term. Cisgender is opposite of transgender. As one book reviewer notes, the most audacious, energetic, and enterprising of the Stonewall riot participants were the drag queens, the homeless queer youth, and other gender transgressors whose position on the farthest margins of society enabled their radical response to oppression. And from Seneca Falls to Selma to Stonewall, we've all seen times when oppressed groups have worked in opposition to one another and times that they've worked in coalition. The invitation is that call to move beyond our most immediate interests and needs and experience that we are deeply part of the interdependent web of all existence, or in Dr. King's words, to recognize that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere, that we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny, and that whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. We need each other as we continue in the struggle. The dream of Seneca Falls continues today in the struggles to end gender discrimination and to ensure equal opportunity and equal pay for all genders. The dream of Selma continues today in struggles such as the fight to make the minimum wage a living wage and to end racial bias in our prisons. Indeed, next Saturday, February 8th, many UUs are joining secular and religious progressives in Raleigh, North Carolina, to protest attacks on voting rights in that state. That protest is being called the most massive moral rally in the South since Selma. You can still go. And the dream of Stonewall continues here in Maryland, where even as we celebrated the passage of same-sex marriage rights, the Fairness for All Marylanders Act, which would prohibit discrimination against transgender Marylanders in the areas of employment, housing, credit, public accommodations, that was stalled in committee. If you feel led to do so, you'll be hearing about ways to encourage that bill's passage this year. For now, I'll end with this quote from the opening paragraph of the sermon that my colleague Meg Riley preached last Sunday during the ordination of a new UU minister. I know it's 12 o'clock, but we had some church to do this morning, so just hang on with us. Reverend Riley began, "We do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message." She said, "Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message." Those words were written by Olympia Brown, the first woman to be ordained by a denomination, the Universalists, before the merger, in 1863. And we know that Olympia Brown did not demand immediate results. She worked for women's rights to vote. She worked on it from girlhood, and she was finally able to cast a ballot in 1920 at the age of 85. Seneca Falls, Selma, Stonewall. The struggle for justice continues today and into the future, and I'm grateful to be on that journey with all of you. And as we continue to hold in our hearts all those who've persevered in the struggle before us, and as we continue to discern our role in the struggle that continue today, I invite you to rise in body or spirit as we sing together the hymn found in the insert to your order of service, Love's Ageless Flame. We're going to sing just the first and fourth verse It's on the front, verses 1 and 4.